Good afternoon, everyone.
We love you.
Thank you. I'm taking a point of personal privilege before I hand the session over to our presiding officer today, Roger Peterson, but so many of you have been wanting to know how Mitch is doing. Our community is so small and the word gets everywhere really fast. And I have to say that I really feel so happy that we're so loved. It means a great deal to me. And I said I wasn't going to cry, and here I go. I want to let you guys know that we ended up taking Mitch over to Kaiser yesterday at the urging of the doctor to go immediately once they read his MRI that they had been trying to get for several days. And they found something in the MRI, and the doctor said, you need to get to the emergency immediately. And we all know our Mitch, and he said, well, I'll go in first thing on Monday. I'm at a conference, she said, no, you'll go in today. So we went ahead and took him in. You know, thank God for my mom and dad who were here that a lot of you have met this weekend. Good. I'm going to tell them they got that round of applause. I hope my mom and dad didn't tell any stories on me, or I hope you guys didn't tell any stories on me. they found that Mitch has an infection in one, maybe two of his discs on his neck. And so he will be getting a biopsy on Monday, and they will begin treatment with antibiotics. He's going to be locked up at Kaiser for about 5 days and at least, and his radio. Yeah, he's going to get to listen to his Trojans. And yes, he was in the ER all night. I didn't get back here until probably 1 or 2 this morning. I was going to give you guys his phone number because he said it was okay. But he's at Kaiser Sunset. He has a direct number. His room is 5106. And, my mother has really been, my mother, my sister, and he ganged up on me. And that's why I'm here and not there. Because my mom said, you go over there, and everyone wants to see you and hear about Mitch, and you have business to take care of, and we will stand guard over here. Oh, well, good. So he is at Kaiser Sunset on Sunset in Vermont. It's here in Hollywood. And as I said, there's a phone number where it's a 323 area code, and the first three digits are the Kaiser number, and the last four digits are his room number. And I left that piece of paper in the room, so I'm sorry. But anyway, he's in the place where he is supposed to be. He's getting very good care, and he sends greetings to all of you, and thank you all so much for your well wishes, and keep him in your thoughts and your prayers. And, prayers of a large family are a good thing, because the man upstairs will definitely hear. And on that note, I am going to give the session over to our second vice president, Roger Peterson. Give him a good round of applause.
This mic. I have to put the mic on top of my braille. How does this work? I don't know. You know, Donna says this is a close-knit community. I just wanted to tell you about, when I was at Telesensory, I kept trying to tell them that it was a close-knit community. And one time I did a braille letter to a customer and I said to my boss, remember I'm always telling you about how close-knit community this is? That letter was to my ex-wife's ex-husband's ex-wife. It gives me great pleasure to introduce for the invocation our very own Reverend Michael Garrett.
Good afternoon, everybody. The Bible says, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. Let's call upon the Almighty One. Gracious and eternal God, we humble ourselves before you, recognizing that you are indeed God the Most High and God Almighty. We acknowledge, Lord, that without you, we can do nothing. And then in amongst ourselves and in spite of ourselves, you continue to shelter us. You continue to shower us and lend us your shadow of protection and guidance. You keep us. You hold us. You protect us, show us mercy. And on this particular time, we lift up our brother, Mitch Pomerantz, to you. In one heart, we ask for your hand of healing, that he might come back to us as his old self. But in the meantime, we ask for your continued guidance and leadership in this organization. Each heart, each mind, help us as we continue to deal with challenges and obstacles that lie ahead of us. We ask it all in the precious Savior's name, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Donna found the phone number.
For those who wish to give him a call, the direct number there at Kaiser, and that'll ring into his room line, is area code 323-783-5106. Again, that's 323-783-5106. And all I'll say is my mother has had him sitting up by the window all day so that he could be strong. He ate his breakfast. He didn't want his lunch, so my mom ate his meatballs. She didn't want the spaghetti, so they're having an interesting time over there. Give him a call if you'd like.
Yeah, Debbie told me she was mediating between Mitch and Donna's mother. Mitch and his mother-in-law. That should be fun. Okay. So I guess we are going into the program. Actually, We do not have a presentation of the colors as was advertised. So I think instead of that, we ought to have a door prize. What do you think? Yeah. $25 from San Gabriel. Yay. I think I know the president of San Gabriel. Yes. And Fudge from BRLC. And by the way, John Ross tells me that they're selling them for 3 bags for $5 now, instead of $2 a piece. The name of Susan Hyatt. There she is. My alternate. Okay. So, the first item on the program this afternoon is a discussion of LAX, the Air City. I guess we're in the suburbs of the Air City here. The presenter is Christopher Moody, who is Airport Operations Superintendent. And he has a long history in working for airlines and working for everybody in the travel industry, and looks like he's served about 2 or 3 careers. But he's going to tell us a little bit about LAX Airport, the Air City. So I give you Christopher Moody.
Greetings, Christopher Moody. And Susan, I cheated. I looked. I picked yours out. Let me tell you a little about my background. I'm older. I'm 61 years old, so I've been in the industry for 41 years. I started off at a young age of age 20 in Riverside, California. My grandfather came out to Riverside in 1914 on a Harley-Davidson. He worked at the Harley-Davidson factory and came out in a sidecar. And my father's brother, unfortunately, named Harley-Davidson Moody. Well, my last name is Moody. What of it? Oh, but I was a travel agent for the first 10 years, and then I went off to college in San Francisco. I'm actually a performer. I sing. I have a deep voice. The people of this island, they call me the Frenchman, though I do not know why. I live right here on this island, South Pacific. Hi, Ed Eller. I can't stay but a minute on account. I just got back from the Kansas City State Fair where I won me $50. So I did 68 shows of Oklahoma where I played Will Parker, and I've been in Music Man and lots of community theater. Well, I was a travel agent, and then I went off to college as a music major in San Francisco, sang some opera, and I came back as a travel agent. Then I left at age 29, started with Continental Airlines, moved from Riverside to here at the L.A. airport at age 29, and from 29 to 46 years of age, I was working at the L.A. airport. I worked in the reservation office. I worked on the ramp, loading aircraft and around the aircraft. At age 46, Continental offered an early out retirement, which was just wonderful because they were paying me to leave, be retired. However, at age 46, it's difficult to retire. I got a job with the City of Los Angeles in operations, which was just a wonderful job. I drive around in a police Crown Vic turbocharged with lights on the top and do runway inspections and taxiway inspections, which is really neat because we're a very busy airport and it's a 2-mile drag strip and my record is 127 miles an hour. Pedal to the metal. L.A. Airport is extremely busy. We are the third busiest in the United States, fifth busiest in the entire world. It would just boggle the mind. So let me boggle your minds. We have, you would not guess, during the summer months, 1,750 landing and takeoffs per day. which translates to about 860 landings, 860 takeoffs, and actually we have more than that because I'm only counting the passenger flights. I'm not counting the Lear jets, the Falcon jets, the business jets, and the cargo flights. A typical day, well, not typical, summer day, August 8th, the FAA tower recorded 925 landings and 960 takeoffs in one day instead of 860. And they said their busiest hour was at 11 o'clock. At 11 o'clock in the just before noon, they had 62 takeoffs and 58 landings. Of course, that's 60 minutes in an hour, and we're talking an hour. It's more than two. In fact, it's we have four runways, so it is every 3.5 minutes we have either a landing or takeoff.
Ella, from my room.
You can hear him from your room too. the LA airport is there's just so much to speak, and I'm very privileged to speak about it because I teach classes. We're in the middle of a major remodeling, and we have lots of construction people. There's a lot of things happening, such as jet blast and dangerous things, and we use a lot of visual cues in the airport to differentiate things: bright yellow, red, blue, don't enter. Movement areas, things of that nature, because auditorily there's much noise, jet blasts, and so much stuff happening. It's very confusing. In fact, one of the confusing things for me in an operations vehicle is that we're listening to the control tower, and we're listening to the jet ground frequency, and we separate the airport in half. We have the south half, two runways, and the north half, and two different frequencies. So I have a radio in one door. The door closest to me, my left-hand door that's right next to my ear, is the busier south side. And the right-hand door, which is the passenger door, is the north side. And in the middle, I have my operations radio, which is either police, maintenance, or operations. So at any time, I could have all three radios going off. And it becomes very confusing. However, if you every day listen to that, it doesn't become confusing. Like anything, you grow accustomed to your environment, and it becomes second nature. And when they say city ops, I hear that no matter. And I know if it comes in the door closest to my left hand, it's from the south ground. I keep the habit the same. But I digress a little bit. I was talking about how busy we are. Let me go back and tell a little bit about the history of the airport. The airport started in 1927, actually a little before that, 1922. There was about 3,000 acres of wheat, barley, and lima beans, and it was called Mines Field, and the biplanes were barnstorming in the 1920s. 1927-ish, there was a big air race at Mines Field, and a lot of the airplanes came in there. And they built the original terminal in 1927. That's when the L.A. airport started, with just two dirt runways. Just before the war, about 10 years later, about 1937, a major, you know, we're gearing up for the war in the 1942s and so forth. So North American Aviation created a big hangar, and they created the P-51 Mustang, 10,000 of them they made for the war effort. They also created the B-25 bomber. 3,000 of those were built. So during the wartime, this was a big, the military got involved with creating air bases. And about the same time in the 1940s, Palmdale and Ontario airports were developed for, and Van Nuys as well, for the military application. So actually, it's called LAWA, which is Los Angeles World Airports, because the city of Los Angeles not only owns L.A. Airport, but they own Ontario, Van Nuys, Palmdale. They own four airports. It's called LAWA. But at LAX, our money is we're a major cash cow for the city of Los Angeles. They're cash cows. There's a the DWP, you know, they take salt water and they throw it through a steam engine or whatever and create electricity. And just for that, we buy electricity. So DWP makes a lot of money. Harbor, because of all the import and export taxes, makes a lot of money. Now, LAWA, or LAX. Vehicle parking lots. When you park a car in the central terminal area, it is now $30 a day. If you stay there 10 days, it's $300. We have four parking structures in the central terminal area. There are 1,800 number of vehicles there. We actually have a metal detector, so when the car comes up, it senses the metal and spits out a ticket. SkyCaps found that out. So what they did was stick a trash can over the thing, and it would spit out a little yellow ticket. So they would wait by Tom Bradley building. When somebody would come out of the international terminal, they said, pardon me, sir, but are you going to the parking lot? And did you park there for 10 days? That's $300. Let me look at your parking. Well, look at my parking ticket. It looks exactly like yours. Just the two different. I bought this today and can't use it. For $50, you can have this ticket. Well, they would pick up that ticket, and as they exit, they didn't realize that we have a very non-technical way of tracking parking structures, and that is we hire a bunch of minimum wage people, and we move them parking structure to parking structure. We drop them off at 11 o'clock at night, pick them up at 5 a.m., and they have a little handheld device, and they indicate at space C15, this license number is here, and then C16, this, so then they upload that into a computer, so as somebody at the exit, when they put in your license number, well, you've been here 20 days. You've been here 10 days. So it doesn't regard, if you lost your tickets, they know how many days you've been in that specific spot. And the guy at Terminal 1 parking structure is never at Terminal 1 2 days in a row. He's at 1, 6, 8, 7. You know, they move them around so that they can't collude with anybody. But it's very interesting. Parking structures, $5 million a month. That's $1 million a month to five-star parking just to manage the parking structure and send these people through and pick up the glass. But there's no vending machines. There's some lighting. There's very little maintenance of the facility. $1 million a month to manage our parking lots, profiting $4 million a month, $55 million in Los Angeles Airport alone, but we have four airports, $78 million for all four airports in vehicle parking. Now, another cash interest is that we have jet fuel. You know, all those airplanes are thirsty. But unlike other places, we don't truck in fuel. No. El Segundo has a big refinery. And that refinery creates Jet A fuel. And we pipe that underground to big holding tanks. So we sell the fuel directly from the refinery into the airplanes. And the airport gets 6 cents a gallon for all the fuel that it takes in. Another big thing is that we have rents. We are a big landlord. $2.10 a square foot. You've heard of smart carts. You can rent those for $4 or whatever it is now. They keep increasing the rates. But it's $2.10 for smart carts and for ticket counters and for hangars and for all the buildings that we own. Everybody pays monthly rents. So we're a big real estate renter of our rents. We have landing fees. Now, landing fees are $4.28 per 1,000 pounds. But those big 747s, we have 80 landings, 747s a day. Those are anywhere from 800 to 1,200, 1,200 per landing. And, of course, I said we had 750 landings. And if you just even say that there were $500 a piece for all the landings. We have PFCs. PFCs are passenger facility charge fees, which the government charges, and that's about $4.20 per passenger. I mentioned we have, if you were at full capacity, 100%, we're an originator terminator. Unlike Denver, Atlanta, Chicago, which is a connecting hub, you would fly in United, get off, and then not go to the ticket counter. You get on another flight and go out. Atlanta, other. L.A. Airport, because we're on the coast, very few, we get off and we originate. Unless you're coming in from Santa Maria on a small regional jet or commuter, you're not going to fly into L.A. to go shopping. You're going to fly in to go to Chicago or see it. Of the 1,700 flights, we have 600 commuter, small business commuters, and those do transfer to the others. But of the remainder, the 1,200 or so are originator terminators and not connect flights. So 250,000 people a day, full capacity, we're probably in about 190,000 a day. And that translates, we're not open 24 hours. We basically close down passenger service at 1 a.m. and start it up at 6. However, if you're in the hotel room and you hear something at 3 or 4 a.m., that's because We have cargo flights. So the cargo flights late at night, the ambient noises, you know, there's not all that external, there's not traffic, so it's a lot louder, it travels a lot further. You'll hear the engine run-ups at 3 a.m., and those are cargo flights that continue to fly throughout the night. But they're much less frequent, one every 20 minutes, but there are at least two or three an hour. So where I get off track a little bit, or maybe not. So we use visual quite a bit at the airport because the auditory is such a noisy environment with all the jet blasts. One thing we use is the color white. White lights are runways. White, remain clear. Those airplanes are traveling 100 miles an hour, and we want to stay away. But coming up to the runway, we'll have surface paint markings. One is like a stop sign, which is red with white, stop sign. And that will have the number of the runway. We have the 25s and 24s. It's based on a magnetic compass, zero being north, and on a compass 360 degrees. At 95 degrees would be 15. And so if you were landing in runway 70, that's 70, 90 being 15, you're heading towards the 230 mark on a clock. So if you're landing on the 7s or 6s, you're landing over ocean. And throughout all of the airports in the United States, we have that same nomenclature of calling out the runways. So you're landing over the 25s and 24s, you're landing over the city, 250 degrees on the magnetic compass. We always land over city and take off over ocean. We land in or take off into the wind. Wind creates speed. It's like the airplane's going faster, gives more lift. The ocean is cold, the land mass is warm, whatever. The wind tends to blow in over the ocean. So most of the time we're taking off over the ocean. We have a noise abatement problem. Noise. Auditory. 12 midnight to 6 a.m. in the morning, we land over ocean, and we take off over ocean. So we try to avoid taking off over city late at night. And then about seven times or so a year, we don't have any snow. We don't have a lot of bad weather. We occasionally have a rainstorm or something. Sometimes we turn the airport around when the wind starts blowing from over city towards the ocean. Then the airplanes will take off in an unusual pattern, taking off over city. So that's what's happening. Some of the technology that's happening with the airports, you know, we have the 747-400, which used to be the largest aircraft, and now we have the 380, which is the triple-decker. The 747, the heaviest configuration is 490 passengers. That's a Philippine airline, so it will have 490. Normally, they run about 380, 390. So the triple-decker that just came out with Airbus with three decks. The bottom deck is all cargo. Second deck is passenger. Third deck is passengers. Two upper decks, the full length of the fuselage. If you were to put just passengers on that, you could put 880 seats. However, the aircraft cannot handle that weight. I mean, when they designed it, they thought, you know, we'll use lighter weight titanium landing gear. And they even looked at a composite skin, which is the Dreamliner 787 uses, but we'll talk about that a little later. They tried to use lighter materials. In the experimental of the 380, they put barrels of water and they tried to get it heavier and heavier. They have completely canceled all freighters, triple-decker freighters, because they can't carry the weight of all the pallets on all three decks. So 880 can't handle it. They have to weight restrict it. It's so heavy that the wings flex, pick that weight, that there were cracks in the wings early on. So they said, we have to seriously weight restrict it. So coming up with the formula, they said, well, we have to carry more than a 747. So what are we going to do? 550 is what they ended up with, 550 passengers. Instead of 880, you know, 300 less, that's a lot. What are we going to do with the extra space? So let's create some room, some area for people to move about. Now, if you've ever taken a cruise, in a cruise ship, you have a small room that you have but you spend all your time in the public rooms. There used to be the blimp. In fact, there was Raiders of the Lost Ark with Sean Connery and Harrison Ford. They spent time in the blimp, and it was a big common area where they had tables and they moved around, and your room that you had your beds in or whatever was very small. So they had this idea, we'll have specialty rooms like a boutique or a library or something, and people. So on their inaugural test flight out of Frankfurt to New York, 550 people on a 9-hour flight, they took off. And guess what the passengers wanted to do? Well, the passengers wanted to stay in their seat the entire time. Not. So the passengers all took off their seat belts because they wanted to explore this airplane. They wanted to spend time in the specialty room. So a room that would hold 30 people had 60 people in it with a line. And all the restrooms had lines. And ding, 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 please return to your seat. And somebody's up on the third floor, and they had a seat on their second floor, and the flight attendants are in the aisles, and people, it was just a mess with that. So recently we had a brand new entrant just come into L.A. Airport, and that's Korean Airlines in Singapore. Their 380 only has 407 passengers instead of 550. So they dropped it another 150. What they did is the entire third floor is all business class, and it's caste system like on a cruise ship. If you're in coach, can't go into business. So that prevents the people from the second floor to go up the third. So first and coach is on the first business, larger movement areas. Now, Arab Emirates, Dubai, the Arab Emirates, they have the 380, and they were having electrical problems. Nobody else was having electrical problems with the 380, and he contacted Singapore and Qantas saying, are you having electrical problems? And no. Well, turns out after the engineers, the designers decided to put a spa on the third floor. Now, an aircraft, when it's up at 60,000 feet, that external skin is very, very cold. And a few feet, 2 feet below, we have 110 degrees. And if you've ever had a Coke and you put your hand on it, there's condensation. So when they looked in the crawl space above the spa, their electrical wires were standing water. So they had to design a dehumidifier and some way to wick off the water. Now, the same 388 had another problem. It was grounded for about 6 months or at least 3 months. And Qantas had three of them in L.A. and three of them in Sydney, and they weren't flying. And the problem was that their engines, which are the Trent 9000s, four engines in the... They're running not 9 hours, 15 to 20 hours at 90% power. Those engines are running with a lot of torque and a lot of heat, and the gearboxes were leaking. The seals were failing, and the oil was leaking out. So when you lose oil, it gets hotter, and you got more stress on the materials. So they found that all the engines had leaking gearboxes, were losing oil. So their solution currently is every 6 months, not replace the entire engine, but every 6 months they have to replace the gearbox on these engines because they're so taxed with 90% power flying for 15 hours at a time. We have a new one coming out. It's just been announced, which is the Dreamliner Boeing 787. What's unique about this aircraft? Well, there's several things, but the most unique thing is its outer skin. We have something called an A-check, B-check, C-check, D-check. A is the most minor check for a few things, oil changes and so forth. D check, they put the aircraft in the hangar for 3 months. They remove the skin of the outer and the rivets, and they take a look at the spars for cracks and so forth. Well, this Dreamliner, because of the Air Force had the 117 stealth fighter plus the YF-74 wrap, which is composite skin, like graphite, like fiberglass. It's applied with a machine, and it's not a metal skin. So this new Dreamliner has a fiberglass type or a composite skin, which is just fine for now, except in 15 years from now, they're wondering, oops, we can't remove the skin to check the spars. But that's okay in 15 years. Well, most of the airplanes have a short shelf life, but some have been up in the air for 20 years or something. So we're concerned about some of those aspects, even though it's a lot lighter and it's more fuel efficient. Another visual thing that you might not be aware of is that there are winglets, which are little wingtip up and down at the very end of the wing. Turned out some years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, a fully loaded 747 could not fly nonstop. Manila, Singapore, it had to make a fuel stop in either Hawaii or Guam. But then they discovered that if you left off about 150 passengers, you could fly nonstop. So they would weight restrict it. So Boeing came up with 747SP, which was a shorter version of the 747 and carried less people. Then someone discovered that if you put the winglets at the end of the wing, where you would tip up the edges, the wind would not spoil over the edge, and the last few feet would have extra lift. It wouldn't come back over on itself and spoil the lift. So it extended the range. So that's why all the aircraft you see have the little winglets on the end of the, so that the wind doesn't come back there and gives it extended range. That's what we have going on. Oh, yes, we're wrapping. City of Los Angeles has 40 departments, Harbor being one and LAWA being one. City of Los Angeles has 40,000 employees. LAWA has 4,000 employees. And all the badge people that work at, 45,000 people are badged and work at the L.A. airport. So I hope you learned something about our airport. And it's a pleasure to be here with you and share some of my insights.
Well, thank you, Mr. Moody. That 250 takeoff must be from right outside my room window because I hear I hear the planes running up to to take off. And all I can say is everything's up to date in Los Angeles.
There we go.
Okay. The next item on my program, or on our program, is one that I'm really interested in. I've been a public transit advocate for a long time and think that we ought to use public transit as much as we can, and I always try to do it. But there are certain hazards in using public transportation, and we keep trying to get the transit providers to minimize those hazards, but they somehow don't manage it. I was just recently on my light rail in San Jose, and I noticed that there are some what I would call moderately hazardous gaps between the cars, which I stuck my cane in and decided not to walk into. Because it didn't have a floor, I found. So we had, as you know, we had a very unfortunate situation not too long ago on the Blue Line in Los Angeles where a man was killed in that situation, walking off the platform between cars thinking it was the door. And we have a report on that from the attorneys who handled it. What happened was there were no criminal proceedings or anything, but there was a civil case on behalf of the family, and we have, as I say, the attorneys who handled that, and we want to hear about it. The presentation is called "Righting a Wrong." Victory in the Cuthbertson v. Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transit Transportation Authority. Say that all in one breath. Brian J. Panish of Panish Shea and Boyle of Los Angeles and Deborah Chang of the same outfit. And I turn it over to you guys to divide it up however you divide it up.
All right. Good afternoon. Let me first start by saying my name's Deborah Chang, and I want to tell you that Brian Panish was on his way here today, and he had a little family emergency, nothing serious, but it needed him to be with his family. So I am here pinch hitting for both of us. But the good news, too, is...
See, that's what happens when you're blind.
The good news is that we have Colin Cuthbertson here, who's also going to be speaking with me after I'm finished to talk about the significance of this case. And in today's world, first let me tell you, I'm going to tell you about this extraordinary case that was just completed this summer. And I'm going to tell you about the impact that this case had, not only in Los Angeles, but throughout the country. And then I'm going to ask for a call for action from this group so that we say that this will be the last time that we talk about someone who stepped into a gap between cars and died. So when I first want to tell you about this very extraordinary case, I first want to tell you that it is really, in this day and age where people complain about too many lawsuits, every once in a while there comes a case that is so important and so compelling that it stirs a community. And I think this was one of those cases. And first, let me first tell you that a little bit about the case, and I'm going to then tell you about a remarkable family, because both Brian and I have practiced for over 25 years, and you know, this family has stood out in all of our cases because they are a remarkable, wonderful family, and I think that made a lot of difference. But on January 28, 2009, a 48-year-old man named Cameron Cuthbertson, who was legally blind, attempted to board a three-car train at Del Amo Station on the Blue Line in Compton. Now, first, let me tell you, he is not the first legally blind man who stepped between cars in Compton. Another man did years before, but he was pulled out, and he lived to tell the tale. But no changes were made even after that event occurred. Now, Mr. Cuthbertson mistook the gap between the second and third cars as the doorway. He fell onto the tracks below. This man never gave up in life, and he did not give up in death. He crawled three-quarters of the way out back onto the platform, screaming for the train to stop with every part of his body because he wanted to live. But the operator did not see him, did not observe him, and started the train. So while attempting to climb back on the platform, his body was crushed. And that is what happens, and that is the risk when there is a gap between cars. Now, let's first talk about this in context. The LACMTA has rarely lost a case at trial. They win over 80% of their trials. Some people don't want to take on the LACMTA for that very reason. Now, on the bus side, it's different. But on the transit train side, they win all of their cases. There's various reasons why. But they are a formidable opponent who has a very good attorney representing them. When we first got this case, we had to learn a lot about what the visually impaired have to go through every day when they want to go from point A to point B, when they want to go to work, when they want to go to church, when they want to go to vote, when they want to serve on jurors. And I think it really opened our eyes because so many things that people take for granted were brought to light in the courtroom in Los Angeles this summer. Now, for over 100 years, the hazard between the gaps between cars has been a well-known issue, and nobody talked about it. There have been a lot of people who have died, and it led to protests in various decades. In New York, they had protests and demonstrations until the New York Transit Authority put chains between the gaps. And I believe in here in California, there was a protest in San Francisco. And so, but you would think that that would end the debate, but it doesn't. Now, the interesting thing that no one knew is that this problem, this between the gap between cars, affected a fundamental civil right. And Congress has made specific
findings. Can we please have quiet? Thank you.
Congress has made specific findings that the right to safe access rail transit is a fundamental civil right. Don't ever forget that. You have a right to safe transit, period. And there's two important laws that came about and that are important for you to know. One of them is the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. We had a remarkable expert who came to testify at trial by the name of Dr. Richard Jackson. Dr. Jackson is a professor at Boston College. He has been blind since a very young age. He had a congenital condition that his siblings had too. And he was born in a decade where to be visually impaired was to be isolated and separated. So he tried to hide his impairment. And he did not want to go to another school. He did not want to be removed from home. So he pretended that he was not visually impaired. And he had a progressively deteriorating situation. He could not succeed in school. He flunked out of school. And he was very stubborn. And he went to work at a car wash place. And he was fired because he couldn't keep the car, the wheels clean. And so he thought, well, I better buy into this system, even though I don't like it, because I can't even get a job. So he went back. He went to a school for the blind. He bought into the system. He ended up going to Harvard and Columbia. And in 1981, the federal government commissioned him and his group to conduct a study for the Department of Transportation to find out, because they did a study, and they were amazed to find that a huge number of the visually impaired community were using transit. And they were concerned, thinking, are the trains of all the other groups we have, this is the only group that can't see, and are they safe? Are there barriers to them in the safe use of transit? So they commissioned Dr. Jackson and several of his people, some of the top leading experts who happened to be at Boston College, and they conducted a study. And they found that one of the barriers was this gap between cars. And they suggested coupling the area. Now, the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, to him, is one of the most sweeping, revolutionary civil rights enactments that there are. In the 60s, you'll remember there was a civil rights movement related to race. And then in the 70s, it turned to people with disabilities. Plain and simple, the Rehabilitation Act says that no qualified individual with a disability shall be excluded from, denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any activity or program that receives federal funding. What we do know is that every transit agency in America receives substantial amount of federal funding. So if anything ever happens, that's one of the first laws you go to, the Rehab Act of 1973. And it made some of the most sweeping changes. Now, the next law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that removed the federal funding requirement. Now, that enables everyone to be able to enjoy the sweeping changes that the Rehabilitation Act tried to start. Now, here was our problem in our case. The blue line at the LACMTA opened up on July 14, 1990. The ADA was not signed into law until 12 days later. The LACMTA tried to say that they were grandfathered from the ADA, ignoring the Rehabilitation Act. But the difference was the ADA had specific language and a specific section that was applicable to transit agencies. And in the specific section, they told transit agencies that devices or systems shall be provided to prevent, deter, or warn individuals from inadvertently stepping off the platform between cars. That is now a federal requirement. But here's a problem. The FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, is the agency that is entrusted with the oversight of everything. You can imagine, after the ADA occurred, there were so many changes that had to occur, even in the buildings of train stations, you know, where, you know, everything from the ticket dispensing machines to everything that you might find, accessible pathways, accessible everything in these buildings. So the FTA has made a commitment where they have these transit agencies reviewed periodically, and they're going to start to ensure compliance in the buildings. They have not moved to the trains yet. So therefore, if you're looking for the FTA to ensure that these agencies are doing what they're supposed to do, you're going to look for a long time. And that's why this case was called one of the most important cases. Because if the LACMTA, which is one of the top five largest, busiest transit agencies in the country, did not protect between the gaps, between cars, then why would some other agencies comply as well? They follow the LACMTA. So even though New York and Boston and all of the major transit agencies did reach some kind of solution very early on, the LACMTA had various reasons not to. We're grandfathered in on the Blue Line. But they realized the difficulty. They had protection on every other line, the Gold Line, the Red Line. Every other line was protected but the Blue Line when Cameron Cuthbertson tried to board a train. The Blue Line is the oldest and longest line in the LACMTA. It goes through Watts and Compton and some of the most transit-dependent communities in the city, probably in the country. It's also the deadliest line in the country. There are more deaths that have occurred on the Blue Line because it goes through an inner city kind of environment. When the LACMTA personnel were on the stand, Brian Panish asked, "Don't you think of all of the lines in the LACMTA, this is the line, the busiest line, probably the second busiest light rail line in the country. This is the line that should have been protected." Without exception, they said yes. So, what we had is a situation, I believe, 19 years of inaction. And a lot of it is because they tried to come up with what they wanted as a universal solution for all of their lines. But they did provide protection on all other lines, except the Blue Line. And that led to some confusion, too, because you have some people who transfer between lines and there is a level of protection on some lines, and then you're transferring and you think and expect another level of protection on the Blue Line, but there is not. And that led to some difficulties as well. So there is a whole host of things that I could tell you that the LACMTA did wrong on that day, but I think it all comes down to 19 years of inaction. And they had worked on this. It's not like they decided we're not going to do anything. They had started a task force as early as 1994. But every year, every decade, they tried new programs. They were going to try wayfinding tiles. They were going to try the platform-based BCBs that are currently in use. They were going to try a lot of things, but it took a lot. They tried to blame the CPUC for a while. The CPUC came in and said, hey, they could do whatever they want as long as they don't touch the platform. And there was a lot of interagency squabbling. There was a lot of interagency squabbling. There were a lot of people who were trying to do it. And the ironic thing that brings us up to January of 2009, the LACMTA was in the midst of a six-month test program for the platform BCBs that I'm sure that this group was well aware of and even helped assist in. And in the midst of this program on the Gold Line, they were, of course, starting on the Gold Line. And in our case, what we tried to bring out is the reason why the Gold Line was so important to them is because they didn't have a grandfather excuse or an exception that they could say, and they were getting a lot of new BRCA cars in. And the BRCA cars could not accommodate the flipper that they had between cars in the Gold Line before. And so to meet the requirements, they had to think of something. So this is why the whole reason for the test program. The ironic thing, too, is also the LACMTA was the holder of a patent for between car barriers, a device that could work on the Blue Line, but they did not put it on the Blue Line. So it is extremely frustrating, and I think a lot of the people who worked for the MTA shared our frustration. But sometimes you can have the best of intentions and want to get something done that you know should be done, and you cannot get it done on your own. And sometimes agencies have the best of intentions, and like the FTA, and they could threaten and they could email, but they don't have the ability to get it done. So sometimes there comes a lawsuit where it puts it squarely in front of jurors who make a decision. And in this summer, in July, when we actually started the trial in June, there were many agencies who I will be naming after in a minute in my call to action, who still to this day do not have barriers between cars. And basically they were watching this case to see, because this case for the proposition that we know there's a law, we know there's some excuses, we know the MTA has worked on it for 19 years. What's going to happen? What's the worst that could happen? Now, I'll tell you, in California, there are requirements that you go through at every step to go through the lawsuit. And one of those steps is you are required to go to a mediation because you try to resolve the situation. LACMTA did not show up at the mediation. And they made, and you know, I respect any party's right to defend themselves in trial. I do. They have that right. But their position was made, very clear. And they didn't say it. But what I thought from it was that they were telling me, with zero offers throughout the trial, is, Debbie, he's blind. He's black. He lives in Compton. He didn't really make any money. What's the worst that could happen? Now, this is me. That's my interpretation. I want to make that clear. But so we went in, as they say in cards, all in, because we had no choice. So we were all in. Now, I want to tell you now, I owe a debt of gratitude to this organization that I don't know if I could ever repay. Somehow, through all of this, we got two names. And those two names are pretty much all you need, and then you get where you need to go. And that's Donna and Mitch Pomeranz. I approached them with some trepidation because I knew that they were active members of the Accessibility Advisory Committee of the LACMTA. And I left a message, with fear. And true to form, they called back. They let me know how important they thought this issue was. But because they do the right thing, they wanted to talk to the LACMTA about it first. They didn't want any behind the back behind the scenes. They wanted everything up and out on the table, talk to them about it, see what they said, and reach a decision and let the LACMTA know. And so they did. And then they decided, we're in. What do you need from us? And we use them, and you know, everyone knows how wonderful they are. I don't have to tell you. but I will tell you, I do have a little cruel streak, I guess, because I would send depositions and things to Donna and Mitch, and Mitch would tell me Donna was crying when she read the deposition. I hope that dog's okay, yes? Did someone step on a dog or no? Oh, has to go to the bathroom. I hear ya. That's perfectly understandable. Okay, so, but no problem. Someone take that dog to the bathroom. I had to sit in court many times when I thought, oh my God. In any event, Mitch would tell me Donna was crying when she read this deposition. You know how tender-hearted Donna is. And I'm so cruel that inside I thought, oh, that's good. Maybe we have a good chance with this case if we made Donna cry. Isn't that just awful? But she's so tender-hearted. She could not. Donna is so kind in spirit and so pure in spirit. She could not comprehend how this testimony could exist and no one do anything. And she, to the day that we were done with trial, could not understand why this case was not resolved. Because let me tell you something, going to trial is not an easy thing. And this is where I owe a lot to the people who are here, because I told Donna, this case is so important that it would be nice to have people here who support us. I didn't know what I was asking, really, because to come to court every day is very hard for me, for anybody. You know, you have to overcome security. You have to go through court. You have to get there on time. There's a lot of people in that courtroom. But we had a group of people who came every single day. And let me describe to you the closing argument. There was, you know, this is not normal, first of all. There was not a seat to be had in that courtroom. You had to come pretty early. And they turned people away. There was some attorney who refused to be turned away. And he sat on a box of documents. And another, he said to him, get off the box of documents. And he said, then give me your seat because I'm not missing this closing argument. But there were so many people there from this organization. I think that made up a good part of one part of the courtroom. I truly do. You don't even have to ask. The Pomerantzes were there. Well, first of all, Mitch Pomerantz was probably one of our strongest witnesses, and one of the strongest witnesses I've ever seen, because you cannot cross-examine him. I think I enjoyed the cross-examination much more than the direct. And let me tell you, too, our last witness was Shirley Manning, who's also here. Let's give her a hand. Poor Shirley was dragged in at the last minute because the LACMTA tried to say that Shirley told them things that she never said. And so she chose to come. You couldn't keep Shirley off that stand. And again, cross-examination was more enjoyable than the direct examination. And we're talking about two people who have never testified in court before, but that just shows you, when you are on the right side, there's really nothing to fear. And they are remarkable. Shirley was at our closing, and she brought people from the Junior Blind of America. And it was so crowded that I think when the jury walked in, they were taken aback. I truly do. And I think what that courtroom showed is the impact that this decision had. The impact of this decision nationwide was not lost on them. Donald Clone, who's one of the world's foremost experts in the ADA, and he is contracted by the FTA to inspect every single transit agency in the country for ADA compliance, including the LACMTA, testified in this case. And he said this case will have far-reaching implications. It will be discussed in advocacy groups. It will be the subject of seminars. It will be what spurs other agencies into action. So let me tell you, after 5 weeks of trial, after reviewing hundreds of documents, the jury returned a verdict in favor of Cameron Cuthbertson against the LACMTA. On July 29th, by a unanimous vote of 12-0, the jury found both LACMTA and the operator negligent. The jury, by unanimous vote of 12-0, awarded Mary Cuthbertson, his mother, $17 million in non-economic damages, $5 million for the past and $12 million for the future. Let me tell you what non-economic damages are. You have two kinds of damages. One is economic, which would be lost wages, anything that you could put down on paper and show. Non-economic damages is much harder to describe. It's described by statute as the loss of love. How do you put a value on that? The loss of companionship, the loss of society. It is something that is very hard in a case. And what the LACMTA was banking is we waived any economic damages in our case. We waived it. We went solely on non-economic damages, and they felt safe. They knew, I think, that the case wasn't going well liability-wise, but I think banking on the fact that we were going on non-economic damages. And remember my thought, again, this is my thought, not theirs. He's blind. He's black. He's from Compton. Let me tell you, this is the largest wrongful death verdict for non-economic damages in Los Angeles County. And if you ever question your own worth or your own value or the effect that you can have on others, this was the death of a visually impaired, legally blind man. Let that go down in the books. Now, let me tell you where we are today, and this is the call for action. The LACMTA has the right to appeal, and you probably saw in the press release they said, this is so excessive, this is outrageous, we're going to appeal. Even though they told the jury, you speak, we listen, when you decide, we accept. And they filed, well, the first step to an appeal is called a motion for new trial. And they asked for what's called a remitter, where they ask the judge, serve as the 13th juror, listen to the evidence, cut this verdict, cut it down. So we had to scramble, we had to write opposite. First they wanted to interview the jurors, the judge said no. We've been writing briefs all summer, let me tell you. If I look tired, this is, let me tell you. But the judge, and I'm holding it in my hand, we just had a hearing last week. In a 15-page decision, the judge denied the motion for new trial. Denied any request for remitter. And basically talked about the extraordinarily unique, compelling relationship in this case. This case was so unique because we had a son who never left home, And while his vision was deteriorating, and I'm going to let Colin talk about Cameron, he had glaucoma and he had a gradually deteriorating visual condition that while his impairment was deteriorating, his mother also had a hearing situation where her hearing was deteriorating. So they helped each other. And we sat in trial. He was her ears. She was his eyes. And together they made a great team. Yes. And can you imagine being deprived of someone who was your companion for 48 years? So basically the court denied it. Now, let me tell you, because I want to turn this over to Colin, because he needs to talk about this extraordinary family, not only himself, who I think is probably the most articulate man I've ever known, but his mother, who I think about every day. When I was so worried after 2 days of jury deliberation, and I know Donna and Mitch have sent me an email saying, we're really upset that the jury has not come back with a decision yet, and I emailed Mitch. They did today. But it was very nerve-wracking, as I'm sure you know. And Mary turned to me and she said, if you pray, don't worry. If you worry, don't pray. And I tried to remember that when I went into the hearing last week, and I think it really worked. So in any event, I want you to hear about this remarkable family, but I have a call for action for you because I see how this group assembles and motivates and works. And it's two-part. Number one, the LACMTA now has a huge decision to make because they tried the motion for new trial. And they can still appeal. It's very hard to appeal when the trial court issues a 15-page decision talking about what she observed in a trial and her rationale. But they have that right. They are well-funded in the sense that they are self-insured for $4.5 million. Up above, it goes to an insurance company who has indicated that they are ready and willing and able to resolve this, and they want to. But the MTA's contract with them is such that the MTA has the final say. Sometimes when you only have to put up 4.5 of a $17 million verdict with 7% interest ticking, it's easy to say, oh, let's fight it to the end because it's not their money. So here's one of the things. They have reacted in the past previously when groups, advocacy groups get together. I know there was on the bus side, there was an elderly person who they all rallied together and they effectuated change in a settlement when a group rallied together. Imagine if the MTA, now that all this is over and the motion was heard, received a letter from every one of you talking about you respect their right to appeal, whatever, but it's time to end this. It's time to get this case done. The Cuthbertson family has waited a long time, and this is just not, they should do the right thing, basically. So that's call to action number one, is this is a formidable group with a formidable voice. And I think the jury heard a lot of that voice. And now it's time for the MTA to hear the voice. But we have the power of not only a jury verdict, but the judge's decision as well. Call to action number two. There are a number of agencies that still have not, this day, resolve the issue of the gap between cars. And we do not want to read another story about someone who became an unlikely hero by his death. We just don't. He is a hero, but he didn't set out to intend to be a hero. I'm gonna read a list of names of transit agencies, and I will also send it by email to Donna so you all have it. But basically, now, this is as of the last date. In the middle of our trial, because of this trial, the Maryland Transit Administration started testing and devising a barrier between cars. So I think that if they're not done, they should be near done. So that's one of them. Let's check on that. Port Authority of Allegheny County. Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority, known as SEPTA, the Miami-Dade Transit, Rapid Rail, Metra in Chicago, the Electric Line, the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District, Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority, Connecticut DOT, the Shoreline East Commuter Rail, Virginia Railway Express, the VRE, and the San Francisco Municipal Railway, the Muni. Does someone here know whether BART has resolved this issue? Because I know they were working on it earlier this year.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
I can find that out.
All right. Because San Francisco really should get this done, both in the Muni and the BART.
Well, the one I mentioned in introducing you is the Valley Transportation Authority in San Jose, in Santa Clara County.
Right.
With their light rail.
All right. And with this, I'd like to turn this over to Colin Cuthbertson.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you, Debbie, for that recap. Closer.
And you can take it out too.
Okay. All right. I don't usually operate from behind a microphone. So bear with me, but once again, thank you, Deborah, for your this summer and for your words this afternoon. Take what she said to heart, please, because this is an effort that if we all work together, we can see it to fruition. I believe we have them down for the count, and I believe that we can go ahead on and put them out. I mean, and by that I mean the transportation authorities all over the country, and it even reaches outside of the country, all over the world. This is a human problem. This is a human issue. We have members of our society and our culture who have various disabilities and challenges. We need to be, as a people and as a human race, we need to be more concerned about one another. We need to hold those folks that are in power, the people that collect salaries, the people that are in positions that can implement these changes and corrective actions. So I know I'm motivated, and hopefully from some of the things that you've heard today, they will keep you motivated, because I know you are a motivated group. As Deborah has said, you've proven that to us over the summer. I've done some research also. This is a very powerful group. So after I've said that, thank you, Debbie, I'm going to read something that I have, something brief that I have prepared. Because once again, I don't operate from behind a mic. I need a script. So here we go. So first of all, I wrote, good afternoon. Special thanks to the Creator, our God, who enabled us all to be here together today. To Mitch and Donna, Mitch is absent, and we pray for him that he gets well soon. The California Council of the Blind, the American Council of the Blind, the Junior Council of the Blind and all their staff and members, to Brian and Debbie and their staff, to Robert Stoll and his staff, and to all the supporters and friends here with us today, wherever they may be. It is indeed a great honor and pleasure to be invited to join such a group of strong and courageous men and women at this blessed event. And on behalf of my family, my mother and my sister and my wife are here with us today, and myself, we pray that each of you continues in God's grace and mercy. A very special thanks to my brother Cameron for his sacrifice that is moving the concerns of our communities forward, for being the catalyst to cause what could be far-reaching changes in the safety and comfort of those of us who have various challenges are prioritized and addressed. Since his death, safety features and devices have been put in place to help prevent the type of incident that claimed his life. The operators of public transportation systems are taking notice of the details related to my brother's death and the serious consequences when a lack of attention and concern contributes to a tragedy. They are understanding that more compassion for and understanding of the needs of the public they serve is job one. Cameron possessed. My brother Cameron possessed a quiet
a quiet spirit, which he displayed throughout his life. He accepted what life sent his way and made the best of it without complaint. He was thoughtful and helpful. He was industrious and creative. He was loving and he was loved. He was my mom's third son. He was my sister's brother and my brother. He was an uncle. He was a friend. He was a fine, fine man. Cam reminded me of other strong men in our family. Both our grandfathers were farmers and had weather, cause, prejudice, and large families to deal with. Nevertheless, their descendants, are here and thriving. They did not allow circumstances to deter them from striving to and reaching their goals. This attitude is what drove us to ask, how could Cam be killed on the busiest rail line in the country? We were sadly disappointed when the research done by the law firm showed that a documented and well-known defect in the design of the train platform interface contributed to my brother's death. This incident also reminds me that people make all the difference. We must reach out and try to help each other. We must use our strengths to offset each other's weaknesses. We'll soon see that we receive the most when we help others. I learned a lot from Cam during his life. He reminded me not to complain because someone somewhere had a situation that was far worse than the one I was in. And instead of complaining about it, do something about it. And most importantly, to help someone along the way. That's all I have right now. Thank you.
Thank our guests here. I want to particularly thank Colin Cuthbertson for that moving statement. And I want to just say that, you know, the things that bothered me most about this whole business, well, of course, was that MTA had the audacity to tell us about how we're supposed to use a cane. Yes. I've got a few ways I could think of to use a cane. but seriously, I really, you know, what this says to me, am I getting through here?
Yes.
Okay, my hearing device is not telling me the right thing. The thing that really bothers me is that I hear at a time in our argument over medical care and everything else that there seem to be an awful lot of people in this world that think there are throwaway people, that some people don't matter. And I think that's really hard for me to understand. We're running late, and we have another presentation, and I don't want to deny us that. So I want to get on to it. We have Mark Jones here from the Disney Parks and Resorts. I know there are a lot of Disney Parks and Resorts fans around. So about the new accessibility features that they have. Reading about Mr. Jones, the thing I thought was really fascinating is that he's a special case. You know, we always like to have folks with disabilities in these jobs. But Mark is a particular case of being a hearing child of deaf parents. So his native language was American Sign Language. And you tell me that they're the best interpreters in the world. I hear. But anyway, let us make welcome Mark Jones, who is going to talk about exhibiting the I'm trying to read Braille with one hand here. We're talking about the new audio description technology at the Disneyland Resort, and I would want to make welcome Jones. Thank you.
Roger, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. A pleasure to be here with all of you. It was great to sit in the back and listen to the previous speakers as well. I learned a little bit myself, all that's done in the community. As Roger mentioned, I'm with Disney Parks and Resorts. I'm part of the team that provides services for guests with disabilities. I have the fortune or bad luck of actually being responsible for both the Disneyland Resort here in Anaheim as well as the Walt Disney World Resort in Florida. So I do get a chance to travel a little bit between the two parks. Last time I was in Florida was about a month ago. I tell you what, it's hot in Florida, okay? And it's snowing, I guess, in the Northeast today. So we're living the dream here in Southern California. I'm here to talk to you today a little bit about some of the new technology that we have available for guests who are blind and that are visually impaired. But I also wanted to share a little bit of a history lesson. It sounds from Roger just talking a bit about this presentation that there are some Disney fans out there in the audience, some folks who've either remember watching programs on television, maybe songs, maybe visiting the parks, etc. I've been with Disney almost 15 years, by the way, so I've had an opportunity to experience a lot of the great things that we're doing. Today's focus, if you will, is going to be on some new technology, but I also, as I said, I want to get back into the past a little bit. A lot of the new offerings we have, by the way, are very reliant on technology. And as many of you probably know and shouldn't be surprised to hear, Walt Disney himself was very much an innovator, and he himself really thrived on technology. I have a quote from Walt. He said one time, "Around here, we don't look backwards for very long. We keep moving forward, opening up new doors and doing new things because we're curious, and curiosity keeps leading us down new paths." When Walt Disney's pride and joy and technological marvel Disneyland opened in 1955 in Anaheim, part of Walt's opening remarks on that day when the park opened for the first time to guests was this: "To all who come to this happy place, welcome. Disneyland is your land. Here age relives fond memories of the past, and here youth may savor the challenge and promise of the future. Disneyland is dedicated to the ideals, the dreams, and the hard facts that have created America, with the hope that it will be a source of joy and inspiration to all the world." Now, I don't have that Walt Disney accent, but I actually can run that through my head and just hear him talking to the crowds that were there on Main Street on that first day. Now, 11 years after that particular speech in 1966, Walt introduced the world to Disney's new project. Everybody remember what that new project was called? Epcot. He actually had a captivated TV audience, and he actually shared this information with them. "Epcot will be an experimental prototype community of tomorrow that will take its cue from the new ideas and new technologies that are now emerging from the creative centers of American industry. It will be a community of tomorrow that will never be completed, but will always be introducing and testing and demonstrating new materials and systems. And Epcot will always be a showcase to the world for the ingenuity and imagination of American free enterprise." Now, building on Walt's legacy and his passion for technology, and in his words, knowing what the people want and building it for them, Walt Disney Parks and Resorts has long been at the forefront of creating accessible experiences for all our guests with disabilities. This includes everything from things like wheelchair access vehicles to a wireless text captioning system. For the audience here today, I want to take you through one of our new technologies for guests who are blind or have a visual impairment, and that's service audio description. Now, I think all of you are familiar with audio description and how it works for movies, but we have a pretty ingenious way, I think, of delivering that type of technology for many of the rides and experiences available at the Disneyland Resort as well as the Walt Disney World Resort in Florida. So since 2009, we've actually at both the Disneyland... Everybody, by the way, knows that the Disneyland Resort is made up of two theme parks. We've got the Disneyland Park, which is the original. There's a second park called Disney California Adventure. And since 2009, we've been offering an audio description-based service there at many of our indoor attractions. There's approximately 25 attractions between those two theme parks that offer this indoor audio description. And what the audio description provides is audio surrounding action settings and scene changes. The service is actually being delivered through a 3x5 device, similar to a BlackBerry or a smartphone in size. And this particular device we call, cleverly enough, Disney's handheld device. And as I said, this particular service is available at about 25 locations today. And sort of as a tie into, by the way, everybody knows Monday's Halloween, right? As a tie-in to Monday, I wanted to give you a snapshot of what that particular service would sound like to somebody who's using it. Now, you're going to hear two voices in the audio clip I'm about to play. The first really quick voice is the male voice, and that is the male narrator that goes with you throughout the entire attraction, that really deep voice that gives you the, sort of the play-by-play throughout the attraction. And then you're going to hear a female voice. The female voice is the audio description track that somebody would receive through their handheld device if they were using the audio description service. So give this a listen.
Our dune buggy rotates and we face backwards. To our left, a knight's armor guards an endless hallway. On our right, wilted flower arrangements surround a coffin. An eerie light escapes as bony hands push up the lid. We pass into the corridor of doors. The eyes glare out from the wallpaper, and bulging and restless doors line the passage. Gilded frames present portraits of ghosts with crazed expressions and daffy smiles. Several doors have door knockers that resemble spiky weapons. They tap on their own.
All right, that's all you get today. Sorry. Don't fear. There's a couple of more clips I have for you here in a little bit. By the way, all of our audio description work, we actually worked with our partners, longtime partners at WGBH in Boston. They are also the folks who provide our handheld captioning and some of our other technology. So they've been a great relationship that we've had for a number of years now. Say that again?
The Haunted Mansion, yes.
Yes. Oh, by the way, a little sneak preview. Towards the end of my chat, this will force you to stick around. I have a gift, a prize that's tied to the Haunted Mansion and Halloween. So stick around for that. That's coming soon, I promise. What I really wanted to talk to you today in particular about, the service you just heard, audio description for our attractions, we've had it since 2009. So maybe you're learning just for the first time today that it's available. But we've had it for a few years now. But the most recent service that we've added to our lineup at the Disneyland Park is now an outdoor narration service. So using the same device, Disney's handheld device, we now provide audio for many of our outdoor areas. And it's done using a series of emitters that we've placed throughout our park, as well as GPS technology. In addition to this sort of outdoor narration, we've also integrated an audio menu. So as a user, you would receive the device, and through a series of tactile buttons, you'd be able to choose how much or how little audio you would like. If you would like information about restaurants or shops or entertainment, or you would like an overview of one particular land, all of that information is provided to you by your choosing. So I guess what I'm telling you is we will just give you a quick snapshot of where you are in the park, but we're not going to keep blabbing in your ear. We're going to let you then choose how much or how little information you want to receive beyond that. The service is currently available at the Disneyland Park for the outdoor locations. For Disney California Adventure, if you aren't aware, there's a whole bunch of construction going on down in Anaheim. We are actually completely redoing our main entrance area. We're actually adding a new land at the park that's going to be called Cars Land. That's based on the Pixar film Cars. So once all of that construction is done in 2012, we're going to be adding this outdoor description service at Disney California Adventure as well. The device that I mentioned earlier, the Disney's handheld device, it's, like I said, similar to a BlackBerry or a smartphone, but it has tactile buttons, which allows a person who is blind or has a low vision, visual impairment, to make various choices on the device that they may need to make. For example, there's two triangular-shaped buttons, which, as you would think, control the volume. We also have an audio menu cluster of controls. It's a series of five buttons, kind of like you would find on a DVD player, with the up, down, left, right selection of choices within the audio menu. And then choosing the center circular button, you choose what particular service you're asking for. There's a square button that is called the Where Am I button. So as you're walking around the park, if you would like to know where you are, you press that button and it tells you. And then finally, there's a diamond-shaped button, which provides the overview of the device. So if for some reason you forget what all those buttons do, you can press the device overview, and it'll tell you a little bit about what the device can do. So I've got a second audio clip for you. What I'm about to play for you, it's two separate clips. The first clip is the description of Main Street USA, which is the main entryway into the Disneyland park. This is the short version. So you receive your device at our guest relations office, which is our sort of guest services area. And as you walk out of the City Hall building, you would hear this particular clip. It's pretty short. You don't really need to do anything for the device to give this clip. The second clip, though, that I'm going to play is a more detailed clip of Main Street. And that is one that you could choose if you were really wanting to get the details around Main Street. You can go into the audio menu, choose detailed description, and then you would get the second clip I'm going to play. So first clip, short version of the Main Street USA audio description clip.
Main Street USA captures the atmosphere of small-town America a century ago. Pastel-colored Victorian buildings with elegant flourishes line a bustling street, leading from a traditional town square to the fanciful Sleeping Beauty Castle. The street is graced with ice cream parlors, restaurants, cafes, and souvenir shops. Horse-drawn carriages, sputtering horseless carriages, antique street lamps, and barbershop quartets add old-fashioned charm.
So that's what we'll call the short version of the Main Street. Now I'm about to play the longer version of Main Street, one you would have to select in order to hear, but it gives you a little bit more perspective on the way Main Street was originally designed by Walt Disney himself.
Main Street USA welcomes us into the Disneyland Park by way of nostalgic buildings, restaurants, and shops. At the park entrance, we're greeted with a colorful flower bed landscaped in the shape of Mickey Mouse's face. We begin in quaint town square. The train station, a red brick firehouse, and City Hall surround a small tree-shaded park with a tall flagpole. City Hall serves as a central location for information and guest relations. Above the firehouse is Walt Disney's apartment, preserved to honor his memory. Steam trains depart the train station on scenic journeys around Disneyland. Attraction description is available. The Disneyland Opera House is home to the Disneyland Story, featuring great moments with Mr. Lincoln. Gold tragedy and comedy masks framed by an arching pediment top the roof. Inside, an exhibit recounts the park's history, and a lifelike audio animatronic Abraham Lincoln shares a moving and historic presentation in the theater. Attraction description is available. In Town Square, at select times, we can board a horse-drawn streetcar, an antique fire engine, a vintage car, or a double-decker bus to travel Main Street. If we peer down the street, at the end we glimpse Sleeping Beauty Castle, the magical symbol of the park. Blue and gold accents color the towers and pinnacles that reach into the sky. Shops, restaurants, and entertainment unfold along both sides of Main Street, with awnings and bay windows on the buildings, and benches and fruit carts along the sidewalks. Guests savor a quintessential small town. The elegant Emporium offers popular Disney-themed souvenirs. The shop is styled with cream-colored balconies and ornamental brackets, and is reminiscent of a grand hotel. Eclectic shops offer specialty wares, the Mad Hatter for monogrammed hats, Disneyana for collectibles, and the Gibson Girl Ice Cream Parlor and Blue Ribbon Bakery for sweets. The Penny Arcade reminds us of old-fashioned games, while the Silhouette Studio creates hand-cut silhouettes for mementos. At the Main Street Cinema, a banner reads six great Walt Disney cartoons. Guests can stop in to see classic short films such as Steamboat Willie. Near the theater is a carved Indian in a feathered headdress. Guests are welcome to touch the painted 5-foot-tall figure. Above the Main Street shop, second-story windows advertise an assortment of business offices. One sign reads, Elias Disney Contractor, established 1895. Main Street is decorated top to bottom for the holidays. The Mickey in the landscaped flower bed wears a floral Santa hat. A Christmas tree with bells and ornaments towers over Town Square, presents piled at the bottom. Garlands drape across the street, each with a Mickey shape in the center.
During the fireworks display, snowflakes fall from the sky.
Did you learn something new?
Yes.
Some of you learned more probably than you ever had to know about Main Street USA. So that's an example of the kind of information you could receive. Additional choices on the audio menu include a listing of merchandise locations in more detail, a listing of restaurant locations and basically the most popular items those restaurants serve, a listing of attractions, the types of attractions that are available, and, of course, a brief synopsis of what the attraction is. So all of those are at the user's fingertips to scroll through and select at their leisure. You can do things or play things over and over again as well. Very cool technology, something that we're very proud of and certainly would encourage if you have an opportunity to be either at Disneyland Resort or at the Walt Disney World Resort. Go ahead and give it a try. The items are available. The Disney's handheld devices are available through our guest relations offices, which is, as I said, sort of our guest service area. It's a $25 fully refundable deposit. So there's no cost to use the device. We just ask for a deposit in case you accidentally take one away with you. And I'll tell you that $25 does in no way cover the cost. But we just take that little small deposit from you. I see a hand. I'm going to do questions at the end, but let me answer one question right now. Yes. Oh, yes, hold on. Yes, if you have a question, and we're, like I said, we'll do hopefully have some time for questions at the end, and then make sure you wait for the microphone so we can get recorded.
Okay? I have a question.
Sure.
With the device, when you talk about the restaurants or the shops, with the restaurants, does it get into, like, this restaurant has specializes in whatever types of food or different things like that?
Yes. Yes, it does talk about what the restaurant specializes in. It doesn't necessarily get into pricing or the A to Z on the menu.
Okay.
Okay.
Also, when they used to have the Main Street Electrical Parade, in the future, when you have those types of parades, will you have the device explain the type of parade and what's going on with it?
We are actually discussing how best to deliver that. The short answer is yes. We are talking about how to provide audio description around a parade and how to, since the device requires triggers for the device to know what it's supposed to do, figuring out a good way to do that. So that includes people technologically well beyond me to figure out a way to make that work. But short answer is yes, we are looking at a way to make that work. I will let you know, by the way, for static spectaculars, if you've heard of Fantasmic or our new show called World of Color, both of those offer audio description as well. So, yeah, I didn't mention those, but those are both on the list. I wanted to mention some additional services that we have available for guests who are blind or visually impaired. These are not maybe the most high-tech solutions, but at the same time, certainly items and tools at your disposal if you need them. For example, Braille guides. We do have Braille materials available at Guest Relations. They are presented in both Braille as well as large print. So you as a Braille user could use it, and if you have somebody who's sort of reading along with you, they actually know what you're reading. It's also in a large print format for folks who need that larger print. And what it does is it provides an overview of the park. So most folks, when they use the Braille guides, a lot of folks don't take it with them. They'll use it within City Hall to get a sense of how the park is laid out, and then from there go on their merry way. If you want to carry an 11 by an 11 and a half booklet around with you, you certainly can, but most folks choose to just use the Braille guide within City Hall and then return it. Some additional services, actually this one's a relative new one with here in about the past month. We've added stationary Braille maps. There are two within the Disneyland park. There's one just outside of City Hall on Main Street, and there's one in the central area that we call the hub, up where the Walt and Mickey statue are, very close to the castle. And these maps are designed to be multi-purpose. It's a large 4 by 5 foot map that is the color graphic that a guest using a standard park map would see in their map. But it also has an acrylic overlay that is both Braille and raised characters. So it serves our guests who are sighted, and it also assists our guests who are blind or who are visually impaired. As I said, two locations within the park, currently at Disneyland. We're awaiting all the completion of the construction before we do our California Adventure installs. If you are traveling across country, do know that all four Walt Disney World theme parks have these, as well as several other locations like Downtown Disney and our sports complex. But stationary Braille maps coming soon to California Adventure and a very new addition at Disneyland Park. For those of you with service animals, do know that we obviously welcome our service animals into our park, and we actually have designated locations within the parks for you to relieve your animal. We have four locations within the Disneyland park three locations within Disney California Adventure. And, of course, the kennel location right outside the turnstiles is also available for you. Final item I'm going to mention, we've got some new stuff that's coming. The technology, the handheld technology, is hopefully going to take us in a lot of directions. I sort of partially answered your question about the parades. There's a lot of things that we're hoping this device is going to continue to do for us as we get more and more into our new openings. When we first released this particular device several years ago, we were hoping to go and buy one that kind of existed in the marketplace, and we found out there wasn't. So we actually built this device ourselves and worked with a company who builds these types of devices in Texas. And the fruits of our labor now provide us this Disney's handheld device, which has been a big hit with a lot of our guests who've come to see us. Over the summer, we had a little bit of a press event sort of announcing the release of this particular service. Here in the room, the Rennies were able to come out and represent the CCB as part of our press event, and we gave them an opportunity to experience the park. So if you'd like to get their unbiased opinion of how things were, you can see them at some point and chat with them about that today or another day. But that was a great event. We had representatives from many of the organizations come for our event rolling out this outdoor service. You know, providing guest service is sort of our goal. We're not looking at that basic compliance piece. I know there are a lot of companies who maybe kind of hope to get by with bare minimum. Guest service is really what our company's built on. Walt Disney himself was very much wanting all of his cast members. We're folks who work for parks and resorts. We're all called cast members because we're part of the show. Wants all of his cast members to interact with every guest and certainly provide the best that technology can offer. So that's kind of what brought us into this world of being able to provide a service like audio description. And we're very excited about what the future holds, especially right here in Southern California. As I said, there's several new things that we have opening here in the very near future. We also have a couple of exciting new projects that were just announced internationally, as well as one that's been announced in Florida. So very exciting things to come. Another final quote from Walt Disney, Disneyland will never be completed. It will continue to grow as long as there is imagination left in the world. Walt Disney World Service, the Walt Disney and Disneyland Services for Guests with Disabilities team will continue to embrace technology to create and enhance the many services that we do have for our guests with disabilities. Now, I want to do a quick, I've got a little bit of time. I want to do a quick trivia question for my prize right here. It's a CD. It's a CD of The Haunted Mansion, and this thing was first released back in 1969, and it's the storytelling album of The Haunted Mansion, so it contains a lot of cool voices and a lot of neat stuff, and this is going to be your prize for the first person able to answer this question. If you think you know the answer, if you wouldn't mind raising your hand, I will identify you and then we'll bring a microphone to you. So I'm looking for a hand and not a blurting out of the answer, okay? Everybody ready? The question is, name the location for Disney's next theme park. I see a hand right here, UCLA gentleman right here in the green, sort of lime green shirt. Microphone coming to you, sir.
Hawaii.
A good answer. The answer was Hawaii. Hawaii has already opened. Oh, no. Everybody's aware. We just opened a resort in Hawaii called Alani, and that opened a few weeks ago. So good answer, not the right answer. I'm looking for the next. And keyword is theme park. There's probably lots of hands that I saw, but the young lady in the back that has the Halloween vest on. Hold on. Microphone coming to you.
Russia.
Oh, incorrect. I'm sorry. Russia is not correct. The next hand that I saw, Joey, in the back at the computer. All the way in the back at the computer.
It's China.
The correct answer is China. Now, you're going to get the prize, but do you know where in China? Do you know where in China specifically?
Ken Metz. Oh, I'm sorry. Say again, I didn't hear.
Oh, you are the winner, sir. I just needed to know if you know more specifically, just where specifically in China.
I don't know specifically.
Starts with an S. Starts with an S, ends with an I. It sounds like Shanghai.
Shanghai.
Yay. Very good. CD is here. I will bring it back to you if I could in just a little bit. Oh, is that yeah, fantastic. Yes, that project's set to open here in a couple of years, an entirely new property in Shanghai. We do also have a property in Hong Kong, if you're not aware. And the other thing that's kind of cool, did anybody have an opportunity to did anybody see the film Avatar? Avatar, James Cameron's Avatar? We actually have just recently went into an agreement with James Cameron and his production company to open up an Avatar-themed land at Disney's Animal Kingdom in Florida, which is set to open in about 3 years. So another cool project. Yeah.
By the way, Mark, the reason that guy's sitting at a computer back there is that he's streaming this meeting throughout the world on ACB Radio.
Fantastic. So hello to all of my people around the world who are listening in. We've got about 10 minutes. Are we okay with that, Roger, if you got 10 minutes for some questions? Is that reasonable?
Yes.
If there are any questions that you'd like to ask, I guess the best solution would be to simply raise your hand and then a microphone will be brought to you, if that's okay?
Yes, it was several years ago, I will admit to that. But I went to Epcot Center. I managed to go on a trip and included Florida. I went to a national convention. And I left there so frustrated because all of your little toys that I could have tried out, that were new and everything, I couldn't get past all the sighted people who were interested in shoving me to the side so they could get to it, and I had no staff intervening.
You mean you had employees that weren't helping, or help me understand that?
No, I had no employee came to help me
and
to
where
get
were,
to
do you, recall where you were?
I was at Epcot Center in the main little thing with all the where you could call for reservations on phones.
Oh.
I couldn't get to the phones. I couldn't get to any of the...
Because sighted people were elbowing you and shoving you
out
of the way?
That's right. I had sighted people.
Nobody likes that.
And I was there with my two children.
Well, that's unfortunate. That's probably... obviously.
And I swore I would never go to Epcot Center again because of that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, obviously not something that we would want to have happen, but unfortunately things like that do happen. I imagine that many of you face that... a lot of times in your everyday lives where you have a sighted person who just doesn't get it. Yeah. I wish we had a solution for you to that, but good information. Thank you. Ooh, I like those glasses that you have on.
Thank you.
Would you mind sharing your question with us?
I'm Joni Apache, and about 8 of us are coming from Sacramento. And we're looking forward to using these devices. And tell me, do you have... like more than one, or do we all have to share?
Oh, no. We have, each park has a minimum of 10. On those days where we know we're going to need more, we can have more.
And would we have to return them each day? We have those 4-day passes, you can keep coming back.
There's a lot of, and I don't know all the technical pieces, there's a lot of things that have to happen overnight when the devices are docked.
Okay.
So they need to be docked back where they are docked nightly. So
good to
answer your question, yes, you do need
That's
to return
great.
Them every day.
Great.
Okay.
And it will alleviate a lot of tension because whenever my husband gets lost, he swears at us. So, it'll help. We won't get lost anymore. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. Wow, we've got a lot of questions. Good.
Yes, Ted Wilbeck from San Bernardino. A lot of my chapter members will be taking advantage of your community involvement program, and I want to thank Disney for that. Very much. And my question is you mentioned that there'll be some construction going on at your California adventure.
Yes.
And will that be going on during the time the community involvement program is taking place?
It's usually in the spring. Help me with the dates on that.
Between the first later part of January into February.
Yes.
So you will.
The park itself is still open. There's just been some... for example, the entrance to the park has been moved to an alternate location briefly until the construction is completed at the entrance. But all of it is designed in such a way to where finding it for somebody sighted or somebody who's blind is all we've thought through that a little bit.
Thank you so much for your community involvement program. We really take advantage of that each and every year. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. I see several hands. If you all just be patient. I think we've got one microphone. So
a lot of Mouseketeer.
Hello, this is Melissa Hudson, and
hello.
I used the device actually just about a week ago.
Oh, good.
And went and checked it out. One thing I was wondering if you guys are thinking about adding, because it was, GPS, and I guess I was, when I got it, I was under the assumption that, when I walked out, yes, it would say you're entering Fantasyland and things, and then you would, click and it'd say, the restrooms are X, Y, and Z, but not... Are you looking at getting a little more detail, as in, you know, your nearest restroom is so many yards away, make a left, you know, that sort of...
A good question. Yes. The device currently is not wayfinding, so it does not walk 10 steps and turn left. It's not to that degree of detail. We are looking at trying to embrace technology, which is more accurate, that will allow us to get to that level of detail, as everybody would imagine, especially a park like Disneyland. There's a lot of things that have been crammed into a very small space. So trying to make sure that that first left we're sending you down is really the left you need to take and not the left that goes into the moat, right? You don't want that. So, yes, to answer your question, we are looking at fine-tuning the device to be able to do more and more and provide more specific detail. Good question. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. This is not a question. It is... I need to share something with everybody. My wife, Connie, went to school in Los Angeles, and one time she took a trip with the junior blind to Disneyland, and when they got to a ride called Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, she sat down, and there was a gentleman next to her, and they started talking, and he said, "Well, what do you think of the ride?" Well, Connie's always been a very direct person, so she says, "Well, it's okay, but it doesn't have any sound. I don't know what's happening." And the fellow just said, "Never thought of that." So when she got off, everybody was all excited. "Do you know who you sat next to?" She said, "No. You sat next to Walt Disney."
Wow. That's a great story.
And the next time she went to Disneyland, that ride did have sound.
Oh, wow. If I'm looking at my clock, I think we probably have time for maybe two or three more questions so we can keep everybody on schedule.
I'm glad I got a chance to speak, because I have been a Disney nut since I was a little kid, and Disneyland, you know, I watched it be built on TV and all that good stuff. I think this is the most wonderful thing to come along, because I go every few years to Disneyland, and I have friends who are totally blind, and they will just appreciate it so much. I have vision myself. I love the place. I wish I could go more often than I do. And one of the people I wanted to meet in my lifetime, wasn't interested in any big stars or singers or anything. I wanted to meet Walt Disney. And when he passed away, I cried.
No, thank you for your comment. All right, I think we're going to do two more questions.
Thank you very much. Just wanted to know, when touring the park, what does one do with the handheld device when boarding something like Splash Mountain?
Well, the device is, it does have a lanyard, so a lot of folks just choose to keep the device around their neck. You can put it into a bag, or you can store it as well. A lot of the rides have pouches that you store it into. So it really is more your preference, quite honestly. Depends on how you would like to store the device.
Waterproof?
You know, it's kind of one of those words. It is waterproof. Resistant. So it is great in the rain. It's great with a splash. It is probably not good at the bottom of a toilet. Okay? All right. One final question. Oh, hi.
Hi. Thanks. This is Bonnie Rennie. I just wanted to say, even though Melissa's experience is much more recent than mine, Bob and I really wanted to thank Mark as well as Mitch and Donna, because I think they did a lot of relationship building work to help with this current event that we had. They really showed us a nice time, and I just want to say the device is everything that Mark says it is. No, it's not. It doesn't tell you where the restrooms are, but it sure tells you a lot. And I'll tell you, when you're with a bunch of people going to Disneyland, you can really have a good time there, but this device makes all the difference. If you have not felt like going because you didn't get as much out of it, when everyone goes ooh and ah, and it's such a dense visual experience that there's nothing like it. If you can possibly go, this is probably the tipping point to make it worth it for you to go. Thanks.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you all very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. If you have any questions or would like to see me and chat a little bit further, can I give you my email address if some of you would like to jot it down?
Sure.
It's pretty straightforward. My first name's Mark, M-A-R-K. And then you just want to make sure you put a period there. So Mark period Jones, J-O-N-E-S, at Disney.com. So Mark.Jones at Disney.com. A pleasure. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Hello, hello. Thank you very much, Mark. And I want to tell you, you do very well with your second language.
Thank you.
Very fluent. Good. Thank you. And you've got an easy name, too.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have one more item here this afternoon. Although, you know, maybe we ought to have a door prize. What do you think? Maybe we can get Mark to draw, man. Huh? Of course, you know, he can draw anybody he wants because he's magic, right? Are we doing door prize?
Is that...
I think Ed ran away.
Oh, my goodness.
He went to Disneyland.
Yeah. So we'll have
okay. to... So maybe we'll have a door prize at the end before we go.
All right.
Sorry.
That's okay.
You know how it is when you're blind. You know, you just... Sometimes,
how is it, Roger?
Oh, just... it's just ever so special.
It's filled with over there.
That's right.
Oh, Ed's here.
Yeah,
Roger wants a door prize.
We want Mark from Disneyland to draw.
Mark escaped.
He did?
How about... Oh,
what is it?
He didn't escape. He's still here.
Yeah. I want him to draw the door prize.
We want you to draw the lucky name.
$25 from Greater L.A. And some fudge.
Kitchen measuring devices from Specialty Adaptations.
Oh, some measuring devices for the kitchen.
Ah.
Kitchen. All right, I'm picking a ticket. Can I read it, or do you want me to give it? Is it mine?
Read it, read it.
David Jackson.
Yay!
You here?
David is treating it the attitude adjustment, right?
Okay. For our last item this afternoon, you guys have heard a couple of times, you've heard Michael Garrett, our national guest and factotum and all that kind of stuff, man about town, and reverend. But we got a special deal this time with our national guests. We got Peggy Garrett too, and Peggy Garrett is the chairperson of the Multicultural Affairs Committee of ACB on the national level, and her title is Exhibiting the Gold, Exploring the Treasure, Embracing the Cultures. So here's Peggy Garrett.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Good, good, good. I don't know about following Disneyland. I don't know about that. I know it's a little late in the afternoon. It's been a while since lunch, and folks are already starting to think about those pre-banquet cocktails and the dinner and everything. So I'll be brief, and I do have some ideas and information I'd like to share with you today. And I'll keep you awake, but I know it's going to be a challenge after all those rides and all that stuff at Disney World. But here we go. When Donna called me and asked me if I would speak this afternoon and talk a little bit about cultural diversity, my first thought was, as chairperson of Multicultural, our theme this year was exhibiting the goal, discovering the treasures, and embracing the cultures. That was kind of in keeping with the fact that this was ACB's 50th anniversary. But what some of you may not know, it was also the Multicultural Affairs 35th anniversary. So we tried to think of a title that would tie it all in together, talk about ACB, but also in keeping with MCAC's mission of working with minority
ethnicities to overcome discrimination. So we tried to keep it all together, and that was the title we came up with. But, you know, I'm more impressed with CCB's title, the theme this year, Making a Difference. CCB, Making a Difference, Advocacy in Action. That, to me, is a great theme because it speaks to not only who you are, but it also speaks to what it is that you do. It says that you are motivated, that you're in action, that you're making a difference, that you're working to achieve goals and improve the quality of life for folks who are blind or visually impaired. And, you know, CCB's done a great job of that. I can think of several of the advocacy efforts that you all have been successful with. And the good thing about that is that those efforts and those successes not only have affected Californians, but have affected people who are blind or visually impaired across this country. But, you know, no one of you could have achieved those goals by yourselves. No individual could have made those changes. It took all of you working together, motivated, and dedicated to those changes to make it happen. So I applaud you today, and I think you should applaud yourselves. Give yourselves a hand for the successes and the differences that you have been able to make. And, you know, I was thinking about California when Donna asked me to speak, and it just kind of popped in my head that California is nicknamed the Golden State. And I never knew why. I thought, well, why is California called the Golden State? What's so golden about California? So I looked it up. I went and read a little bit about it. And I found out that it started back in 1848, 1849 with the gold rush. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that's good to know. But then down through the years, there have been other instances. You have the Golden Gate Bridge. You have your beautiful fields of golden poppies. And you have your golden sunsets. Back when I had more sight, in 1999, I had the opportunity to attend an ACB convention here in L.A., and I actually got to witness some of those golden sunsets, and they really are beautiful. They really, really are beautiful. But it doesn't stop there with the sunsets and the flowers and the Golden Gate Bridge. CCB has some golden people. Somebody agrees with me. And I call them golden people because they're folks who have dedicated their life to making a difference. And those differences aren't just for people who are blind and visually impaired, but they're also for people across disabilities, people with multiple disabilities. They have dedicated their lives to improving the quality of life for all folks. I've had the opportunity to meet some of those folks and to work with some of those golden people at the national level. We worked on various committees and task forces, many different activities. I've had an opportunity to meet some of you this weekend. But even though there are many golden people who've done many things in CCB, I dare say that there are many more golden people in California and in CCB, and maybe some right here in this room today, who are what I call undiscovered treasures. And I call them undiscovered treasures because these are the people who have talents and abilities who have not yet stepped up to the plate for whatever reason. Maybe they've not been invited. Maybe they're unsure about their talents and abilities. But for whatever reason, they're undiscovered treasures. You know, undiscovered treasures are kind of like missing pieces in a puzzle. They're kind of like missing clues in a treasure hunt. I don't know how many of you here ever had enough sight to put together a jigsaw puzzle. But I grew up as an only child. I didn't have a lot of entertainment, so a lot of times I had to entertain myself. My mother was very strict. I wasn't allowed to spend a lot of time away from home, nor were a lot of other kids allowed to spend time in our home. So I had to find ways of entertaining myself, and one of my favorite things to do other than reading was to put together jigsaw puzzles. And I had some puzzles that I just loved, and I would put them together over and over and over because I loved the picture that it made when it was completed. But somewhere along the way, I'd lose a piece of that puzzle. Every time, it just, you know, happened every time. And I could put it together, but the piece that was missing was always close to the center. And it would frustrate me so much because the picture was not complete. And it's the same thing with a treasure hunt. And I'm sure that all of you at some point have gone on some kind of treasure hunt, a scavenger hunt or something, and you know that if you miss a clue, if you can't find one of those clues, you have a difficult time finding the treasure. And sometimes you can work together, you can team up with somebody else, and eventually you might find that treasure. But you work twice as hard, and it takes you twice as long because you're missing a clue. And it's the same thing when you're missing those undiscovered treasures, those golden people who can help you make a difference, who can help you to achieve your goal in a shorter time with a whole lot less work. Undiscovered treasures, those golden folks that you really need. Let me ask you this question. Have you ever thought about what life would be like if everything, everybody, everything was just same? Monogamous, nothing. No variation, no diversity, everything's the same.
Like Utah.
I'll give you an example. Roger. What if the only flavor that was available to you is, let's say, butterscotch? Yeah. Now, I personally like butterscotch. Don't have anything against butterscotch.
He's a good dog.
But it's my favorite flavor. Now, if I woke up one morning and my chocolate was gone, I would be a most unhappy camper, okay? And I think there are some others out there that agree with me. What about colors? What about colors? What about if the only color we had was, oh, let's say purple? Now, I know some folks say, well, you know, we're blind. We can't see colors anyway. It doesn't really matter. But just for fun, I want everybody in this audience to shout out to me what color or colors you're wearing today. I don't think a color was missed. I think I heard every color known to mankind just about. And that's what life is about, you know? Well, let's just look at music. Let's just say, how many people in the audience like jazz? How about gospel? Country western?
Yes.
Oh, wow. What about, well, let's put it this way. What if we woke up tomorrow morning and the only music that we had left was opera? Yeah. You turn on the radio, all you hear is opera. You turn on the TV, even your commercials are done in opera. I hear you. And what about spices? Salt, pepper, cinnamon, one of my favorites, ginger, chili powder. But guess what? That's all we have left is garlic. Garlic on your eggs, garlic on your vegetables, everywhere you turn, just garlic. You know, the point I'm making today is that variety contributes so much to life.
cultural diversity contributes so much to life. People contribute so much to life in all of their diversities. Each one of you brings something very special to CCB. You bring something that only you can offer because God has created each person as an individual uniquely with his or her own talents and abilities. And nobody can take that away from you, but nobody can fill that space that God intended for you either. Together, you make up CCB. Together, you're making a difference. But remember that there are still those undiscovered talents out there. There are those folks who are just waiting to come in to help you make a difference. I had a conversation a couple of different times since I've been here with various people, and we talked about the fact that we've been in the trenches for a very long time. And some of us in a few years are going to want to pass the baton on to other folks. Some of those undiscovered treasures may be your future leaders. They may be the folks who can help you to make a difference and help you get there a little faster and a little easier. All those different cultures that may seem different, they're not different. We're all the same. We all have the same goals. We all want the same things. We all want the same varieties. We want vanilla and chocolate, and we want garlic, and we want salt. And we want chili powder, and we want cinnamon, and we want to wear pink and yellow and green and blue and purple. We all want all of the same things. And working together is the best way to achieve those goals. So in this golden state, with all of your golden people, and some not so golden because you guys have Arnold Schwarzenegger, or you had him. But you know what? On the other hand, Texas has Rick Perry. And we're trying to get rid of him, too. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But as I said, in this golden state with all of your golden folks, don't forget to look and embrace, look for those undiscovered treasures who may be hiding somewhere in those cultures needing to be embraced. Welcome them, bring them in, and allow them to help you continue to achieve your successes and reach your goals. Help them and allow them to become advocates in action as CCB strives to move forward in the future. God bless you in all of your advocacy actions. I've heard some things here today that I wasn't aware of that you all have been involved in. But just remember that there are many, many more obstacles. There are many, many more fights to be fought. And together, everybody working on the same level, achieving the same goals, you can do it. As our president says, yes, we can. Thank you. And I told you I'd be brief.
And you were. Thank you, Peggy. So I think we are getting ready to close this session. And
door
I think,
prize, door prize.
And I think it's in... I don't know. Do we have time? Do we have time for a door prize?
We do.
Okay.
We do.
The president says we have time for a door prize. Even though if we stay here too long, the room may not be ready for a banquet.
It's 3:57.
All right. So we'll have a door prize.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have a knitted wall hanging from Mary Beth Randall and the Guide Dog Users of California. We have a bag of fudge from the BRLC.
Oh.
There you go.
Num, num, num.
How could you beat that?
Sure.
This is Aisha. Aisha Went. Are you here?
Oh, that's what
what she gets.
Keith Jackson.
Sorry?
Keith Jackson.
Keith Jackson?
Keith, is it Jackson or Johnson?
Artist Basin.
Artist Basin.
Artist.
She left too. She left too. Okay. Everybody left.
Oh, she's probably breaking down the Glendale Bourbon booth. So.
Heavens. Monique McCorley.
Yes!
All right. I think Monique is here.
I think she is.
Sounds like it.
All right.
Sounds like it.
Okay, so we have some meetings that are going to take place between now and the banquet. I remember that there's governmental affairs, there's fundraising, there's hearing impaired, vision impaired, deafblind, whatever you call it, and.
And there's the BSC Student Social.
And the BSB Student Social. Those students just party all the time, don't they?
That's a song.
Oh. Yeah, the visual and hearing impaired was listed in the program as being in this room. And I'm afraid they would carry us away with the chairs or something if we did that. So we're going to be next door in B. Marie Herrera has an announcement, I hear.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. This is Marie Herrera from the East Los Angeles chapter. I just wanted to notify you something about hospitality. We've been having a bartender come for the last two nights, and he'll be here tonight. His name is Rafael Enriquez. He's a former student of DPI at the Junior Blind of America.
They teach all those skills there, huh?
He was cited when he used to be a real professional bartender. He is partially... He misses being a bartender. He's enjoyed practicing again for the last two nights, so I hope that you'll thank him for his service this evening when you come. He makes the most delicious Long Island iced teas, margaritas, 7 and 7. But please thank him for coming to donate his time, and it's really meant a lot to him to help you, help fellow visually impaired and blind people. And many of you don't know, but he's got a little tip jar there. So just in case you want to thank him, it'll be there, okay? But I just wanted to let you all know that, yes, he is just like one of us. He's visually impaired. Thank you.
Marie, I think you should be careful with those Long Island iced teas.
Oh, as long as you buy me one, Roger. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to recess now, or adjourn, or whatever it is we're doing. And we need everyone to clear the room as quickly as possible so that we can indeed let the hotel set this room up for the banquet. So...